the pursuit of truth in any field will suffer from fundamental distortions if God is overlooked. Only within the perspective of ultimate reality can we come to a proper understanding of ourselves and of our world, and to a proper way of living in it. The history of human involvement with God has its negative face, as we've already indicated. False conceptions of God continue to wreak havoc in the field of human thinking and human living. The distortions and their effects can scarcely be exaggerated. The positive face is that of the human beings we acknowledge and revere as saints. And there are hosts of them in every culture, every country, and every generation. What we need here, more than anywhere, is commitment to the quest that incorporates a careful and honest reflection on the lives of those who inspire us by their obvious fruit of their own commitment. We need also to learn from our own and other people's mistakes, to purify the concepts of God by paring away ideas that have led to distortions of a truly human life. From the goodness, the love, and the overall quality of the humanity of others, we can learn to respect the insights into God that inspire them. It's possible to live our daily lives without being engaged in this quest for God. However, admiration for what is beautiful and commitment to values that demonstrably enhance our experience of the world invite us to explore the question of God. We cannot expect to achieve a completely satisfactory answer. For to do that, we'd need to have complete comprehension of everything that exists. Whenever we have a new experience, whenever someone new comes into our lives, we discover something more about reality, and so about God. However, we can continue to refine our understanding by eliminating error and learning to modify the direction of our thinking and of our choices. Inspired by the wonderful people who've gone before us and who accompany us on the most exacting and most fruitful of journeys. My aim here is not to prove the existence of God, the one way one might prove the existence of something by providing incontrovertible evidence that must convince anyone willing to attend to the evidence provided. The transcendent God cannot be put under a microscope. My aim is to invite you to attend to aspects of your own experience that might persuade you to continue to explore the mystery and not to dismiss it because it doesn't deal up the ready evidence that our empirically trained scientific minds have come to expect. I find my choice to believe confirmed by my experience of love. I think it's our yearning for love, that is our yearning to belong, that drives the quest for knowledge upon which we've been reflecting. It's our yearning for communion, the yearning that drives all our connections with reality. Our urge to know is propelled by our longing for communion. We're made for love. Love is the experience of our inner intercommunion, our communion and connection. The other remains other. I'm not you, but another to which and to whom I belong. This is because everything we experience is drawn towards the other in whose being we all participate, the one in whom we live and move and have our being. We are attracted outwards to ever more intimate communion with the world around us. And when we experience love, the word we use for this communion, we're attracted inwards to plumb the depths of the inner world that love discloses. Our experience is that our instinctive desire to be in love, brackets, to believe, to give and receive love, and to enjoy communion, it does connect us with reality. Our desire, however, is limitless, like our desire to know. Nothing we directly experience can satisfy our longing. If there's no object that can satisfy our limitless desire, the desire is, in the final analysis, absurd. In the choice between absurdity or meaninglessness and mystery, why not choose mystery? The existence of the infinite one with whom ultimately we long to be in communion, the one we call God. In the words of Augustine, "You've made us for yourself, O God. Our hearts are restless till they rest in you." It's clear that our experience of love never provides full satisfaction. For there are depths to our heart and to the world that remain to be explored. The inner well seems bottomless. Our yearning seems limitless. Our longing for love seems inexhaustible. When the yearning is partially satisfied, we rightly conclude that it was not something that is merely subjective. We know that we're not living in a world of fantasy. We know that we are truly in communion with something real. However, we also know that our yearning is not fully satisfied. We long for a love that is unconditional, unrestricted, complete. Our limited experience of love gives us reason to trust this yearning. It's not reasonable then to trust that there exists, is it not reasonable, to trust that there exists a reality that accounts for the ultimate longing which we experience? A reality which is its ultimate object and which alone can fully satisfy us. Why would our yearning be real and trustworthy in partial matters, but ultimately be unreal and deceptive? Why would we not explore the direction in which our experiences are pointing, just because they point to a reality that transcends our present experience and so remains mysterious and beyond definition? This is the reality I'm calling God. Why not remain open to what Karl Rahner speaks of as the one who is an incomprehensible and improbable outpouring of his love, communicates himself with his inmost reality to his creatures without being consumed in the fire of divinity? They are able to receive God's life, God's very glory, as their own perfection. Just as knowledge that comes through love takes us to a degree, a deeper appreciation of and connection with reality than knowledge that limits itself to rational logic, so in knowing God, I'm quoting again from Karl Rahner, the human being can draw nigh to the incomprehensible God, who remains a mystery, only in loving surrender. Not with a knowledge which brings the object known before the higher tribunal of knowing. This is not a regrettable remnant of a penetrating knowledge, but rather this experience constitutes the ultimate and original essence of knowledge. We learn more through love than we can ever learn from the applications of logic. Critically important, though logic and reason are, in our search for truth. The choice to believe in this God has necessary implications. Radically, it means that my very being is received. I have nothing that I have not received. It's God who sustains me in existence and inspires everything I am and do. What I in fact do and what I in fact become depends on how I choose to receive or not receive from God. To the extent that I'm open to welcome grace, that's what we mean by faith, by the way, to the extent that I'm open to welcome grace, my life and my living will demonstrate the creativity of being and acting in accordance with divine inspiration. To the extent that I resist inspiration, I remain distracted, out of touch, inauthentic, stunted. I'm forever experiencing a being drawn to transcend my present self. I'm forever experiencing a resistance, a wanting to hold on to what I perceive myself to be, a fear of the unknown, a complacency, the weight of habit. I now am the consequence of the decisions I have made for good and for ill. One of the key distortions that we find in the history of religions is the projection onto God of the notion of control. Control plays such a big part in society that it's not surprising that those in control and those being controlled have included the concept of control in the concept of God. Jesus saw God as love. And as we adults experience it, love does not control. The word love, though inadequate, points in the right direction. The word control does not. Thinking of God as love sheds light on many of the things we do know. On one level, there's the reality of an expanding universe and of gravity. People speak of the experience of the sacred. This accounts for polytheism, the sacred sensed in a mountain, a stream, a grove of trees, and the star-spangled heavens. We have come to recognize the fact that everything we know is related at a profound level. I think this is quite a modern experience. Everything is related at a profound level with everything else. Monotheism makes more sense of the world as we know it. There's also the reality of love between persons. If the God required by intelligence and reason is love, so many of our human experiences of the presence of love, but also of its absence, make sense. It seems to me that it is the introduction of the concept of control that pushes intelligent people in the direction of atheism. We're always hearing people say, how could God allow this? How could God permit this? Why did God do this? Why did my grandchild die as a child? As though God were running all that and making all those decisions. But if God is loving everyone in all those varying situations, which depend on, have to be discovered by where you live, what you're drinking, what kind of stuff was in the food, and on and on and on and on and on. We can work at that scientifically. But if we ask where God is, for example, on Calvary, many of us were taught that God organized Calvary. God wanted his son to die to save us. So the theology was caught up in a God of control. What about if God is love? What about if God was loving Jesus? And the two men on either side, sustaining them. What if God was loving Mary of Magdala and Mary and the beloved disciple and the soldier who maybe risked his career by getting some wine and holding it up to Jesus to try and drug him a bit? I don't know what he risked. What about the people who went back beating their breasts because they thought, we've got something really wrong here? If God is love, and instead of asking why God did something, we ask, where is God in this that is happening? And then look for love. So this whole idea of control, I think, has critically distracted us from the God revealed by Jesus. What kind of control did Jesus have when Judas came and kissed him? I was taught as a little child that since Jesus was God, he could have pulled himself off the cross. But he loved me so much, he didn't. I'm not blaming the sisters or whoever taught me and was for that stupid idea. But Houdini couldn't do it. Why could Jesus pull himself off the nails? two more slides and I'm complete. All of this points to the need for constant correction and purification of our concepts of God. And brackets, great care in teaching children. There's a program on TV, which I never watch biblical programs on TV because the Bible's pretty good. And someone rang me from Sydney the other day and her niece was watching the thing on the Bible, and you may have seen it. And the little niece was traumatized. How could God be so cruel? How could God do this? Why did God do this to the Moabites? Why did God kill all the Egyptians? And of course God didn't kill the Egyptians. It says it in the Bible, but it's wrong. Are you okay? God didn't go around killing all the firstborn Egyptians. It's an ideology. It's saying something, and we've got to work hard to find what they're getting at. Well, any other program seems, up to this stage, to be presenting a violent God. I haven't watched it, so I'm not commenting on it. But this auntie had a lot of work to do to persuade the child that the images weren't images of God. So this points to the need for constant correction and purification of our concepts of God. Christian tradition does this. How fortunate we are, by focusing on the person and life of Jesus, drawing on the experience of his contemporaries who found in him a perfect human expression of God. Every word Jesus spoke connected them with this search we've been talking about all morning, with God. His silence connected them with God. His holding people, his unwillingness to condemn a woman caught in adultery or to reject a leper. And you know the whole gospel story. He was presenting something stunningly beautiful, threatening the religious ideologies of the people who were in control, but somehow enough people got it for us to be here today. Their experience has been reaffirmed by the countless millions of those since who've looked to Jesus and committed themselves to live as his disciples. They found him to be indeed the way, he said, to God. Follow me. Come, follow me, he said. The way to connect with their deepest yearnings, and the way to connect with God. Reflection on the person, life, and significance of Jesus has been for Christians the richest source for their reflections on the meaning of God, and so for their reflections on the meaning of human existence. The Catechism is a summary of what we've learned by listening to Jesus and living under the guidance of his Spirit. So I conclude this lecture by returning to a statement made in the preface of the Roman Catechism, that is, the Catechism authorized by the Council of Trent. It's quoted in the new, or the 1982 Catholic Catechism upon which we're reflecting, and this is what they said, the fathers of the Council of Trent wanted us to know this. And this is ground zero. Everything has to be checked by this. The whole concern of doctrine and its teaching must be directed to the love that never ends. Whether something is proposed for belief, for hope, or for action, the love of our Lord must always be made accessible so that anyone can see that all the works of perfect Christian virtue spring from love and have no other objective than to arrive at love.
Created this out of love,